My guest in the studio tonight has worked and recorded with some of the great international jazz musicians, such as Dizzy Gillespie, Branford Marsalis, Anita O'Day, Nancy Wilson, Herb Ellis, Ray Brown, just to name a few. And with 29 internationally released albums under his belt, he's considered one of the driving forces of improvised music and modern jazz in Australia. Serge Ermol, welcome to Frank Presley's Now's the Time.
Hi, Frank. It's lovely to be here.
Serge, it'd be fair to say, I guess, you'd be one of the more colourful characters of Australian jazz, and that's probably partly due to your heritage. Your parents were Russian. You spent an early part of your childhood in China. But your father was an orchestra leader in China. Briefly, tell us about your background.
I was born in Shanghai in 1943, and my father was a very prominent band leader. In those days, Shanghai was like the New York of the East. Nightclubs everywhere, jazz music. The American musicians used to stop over and play with my father's big band, i.e. Buck Clayton used to play with him. Louis Armstrong would come through. And my father had friends like Charlie Chaplin. The movie people were there. It was an unbelievable place. So, of course, and my father also played in the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra. He played French horn. And he always used to take me along as a little tiny kid. And I'd be there amongst all the music for rehearsals, not for performances, of course, but for all the rehearsals. My grandmother used to sing in a Russian Orthodox choir, and I'd be there at rehearsals listening to that. So, of course, music was part of my life, an integral part of my life. And consequently, when we arrived in Australia in 1950, after the Chiang Kai-shek was overthrown by Mao Zedong, the revolution, we settled in Sydney. And, of course, my father couldn't afford a piano. He bought me a trumpet. So I started to play the trumpet. But in Shanghai, I'd already, at the age of four, was playing very simple Chopin. But they couldn't afford to maintain, you know, that sort of stuff in Sydney. So they bought me a trumpet. So I played trumpet for some years. And in my teens, I went back onto the piano. I was playing Louis Armstrong trad stuff.
Was your father a big influence on you as far as your musical taste?
Yeah, a great big influence. He used to beat the living hell out of me if I didn't do the right thing by what he wanted me to do musically. And it was all Louis Armstrong stuff, which now I thank him greatly because they had tremendous roots to come from. Louis Armstrong music and all that type of music was in my blood and is in my blood now. But then I went into a store to buy a Louis Armstrong album, and the guy says, "Try this. It's Dizzy Gillespie's Half Trumpet Will Excite." And I saw this weird black guy with a trumpet bent and everything, and I thought, man, that's really weird stuff. So I listened to it, and I was really knocked out what I heard. And then, to cut the long story short, I went past the El Rocco one night, and I heard the Dave Levy Trio, and I just couldn't believe what this guy was doing. You know, he was improvising. And I just fell in love with it. And I met Leonard Young then, the drummer, percussionist, who was a legendary figure, as he is now. And he more or less took me under his wing. I used to come in and insist that I'd sit in. I wanted to sit in. "Come on, Len, can I sit in? And eventually I got a gig there. And I used to, rehearse with Len and our trio.
This is the early 60s?
Yeah, early 60s, yeah. And Leonard Young was called Lenny then. And it's a 2 o'clock for rehearsals at El Rocco, so I'd be there waiting for an hour, 3 o'clock, 3:30, he's not there, you know. The master teaches the pupil, the sensei, musician, you know. And I learned a lot from Lenny. I mean, this is an incredible story because all the young jazz musicians of today have got the very comfortable facility of the conservatorium and jazz study courses. We didn't have that. We learned in the street. I'd ring Tony Kirby up, a great piano player who's passed away now, who used to work at the El Rocco, and say, "Hey, Tony, what are the changes for the bridge of Killer Joe?" You know, and he'd tell me. Leonard, during our rehearsals, he'd just put a record on, and he'd play four bars, and he'd say, "Did you hear that? Now play it." And I'd be struggling, trying to play this thing. No, that's wrong, Serge. Listen to it again, you know. And that's how I learned, and thanks to Lenny, I'll always have my hat off to Leonard Young, because when you learn like that, you're really learning the guts of the whole thing. It's not an academic exercise like it is today. But I think it's a great thing that's happening today to the AFLs, because they cut, you know, they don't have to wait like I used to have to wait. Jesus, how am I going to get the changes to that? Who can I ring, you know? Chuck Yates. No, I'm not going to give it to you today, sir. It's just, I tell you what to do, Dave Lee would say. Just learn the 2-5-1-6 in every key, and then come back and I'll give you the changes to, you know, Lush Life or something like that.
Yeah.
That's how we learn. It was very exciting, actually, to be quite honest with you.
You've obviously had influences in the spontaneous, instantaneous, improvised music area, people like Cecil Taylor. Who others would you nominate as huge influences as far as the piano is concerned?
Well, they're all spontaneous improvisers, except a lot of them tend to play the changes, you know, with barriers, parameters, chordal structures and stuff. Well, my influences are, well, Keith Jarrett. Bill Evans is one of my all-time loves. Keith Jarrett, McCoy Tyner, Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, Cecil Taylor. He's crazy, man. Breaks all the rules. But everyone is a spontaneous improviser and everyone is a spontaneous composer. When you're composing a piece and you're writing it down, you're really improvising. Except when you're actually improvising on the gig, you're doing it straight away, spontaneously.
Now, you've played with some greats, there's no doubt about that, and we've got a track lined up here where you're playing with Herb Ellis and Ray Brown. Tell us about that experience.
Well, that was a pretty horrific experience because the producer, Peter Noble from AIM Records, made it possible. He also got me to do an album with Richie Cole. They were all out here together on tour, Herb Ellis, Ray Brown, Richie Cole, Sonny Stitt, and Peter Noble came to me and said, would you like to do an album with these guys? I said, sure, love to do an album. And he said, now I'll tell you something, Serge. Herb Ellis said to me, if you don't cut it after the first few notes, they're going to split from the studio. That was a great thing to tell me, because I was on a razor's edge from that moment on, dry reaching in the toilet and all that before the gig.
Yeah.
And I was so nervous, we did the first thing, Triste, by Joe Bim, and Herb Ellis must have sensed how nervous I was, because he came over after the thing, and he sat next to me on the piano stool, and he put his arm around me, and he said, hey, man, he said, we're going to have a great album. And from that moment on, I just relaxed.
Yeah.
I wanted to kill Noble, you know, bang.
But you needed that adrenaline to get you going.
It was unbelievable adrenaline because of it. You know, whether it was an inadvertent thing that he did or whether it was a premeditated thing, I'll never know. But it was certainly a big rocket. When I arrived back from overseas, Dave Levy gave me his chair. Dave Levy had been there for two years at with Eddie Santos, and I stayed 2 years with Eddie. He was a great, incredible guy. Lovely, and he just passed away recently, you know. And this is a dedication to all the other fallen jazz angels, as I put it. So many, it's unbelievable. I wanted to do this because it's my contribution. It's my way of saluting all these people and trying to get other people to be more aware. I mean, usually we go to wakes. We go to the funeral, we go to the wakes, and everyone plays. That's beautiful, that's fine. I went to Keith Sterling's funeral. I didn't go to the wake, and I didn't want to play, but I didn't go to Joe Lane's funeral at all. I just couldn't. I was truly shocked by it all. And this is my way of sort of contributing to all those fallen jazz angels.
Serge, those great names we mentioned in the introduction, you must have some significant moments that stick in your memory. Can you tell us about some of those as far as maybe any memories of Art Pepper at all?
Sure. I met Art Pepper when he came out here, also for Peter Noble. Peter Noble brought out many Americans here. Jimmy Witherspoon, too. I played with him, too. But Art Pepper was a mess, unfortunately, when he came out here. He was on his last legs. And I'm afraid a lot of the people came out just to see him like that, you know. I met George Cables. From that particular tour. And then I got George to come out here, and I toured him around Australia. Very successfully, too. He's great, one of my favourite piano players. Yeah, I walked into the... When Art was playing, I walked into the dressing room with an album that I had called Dedication with strings and stuff. And I said, hey, Art, my name's Serge, blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, yeah. I don't know whether I should mention all these things, but all he was interested in scoring and all the people would know what that meant, you know. And he wasn't interested. It was opaque. He was a really sick man. But he played good. He played great.
Photos of him at the time, I recall, he's very, you know, sunken eyes, drawn.
Yeah, it was like a skull when he was here.
He had some sort of complications from an operation, didn't he? He had some sort of growth in the, at the front of his...
Oh, he had everything. He had liver problems, kidney problems. He was walking around with a colostomy bag under his shirt. And he didn't eat well. All he wanted to do was get high.
Sad, but what a great player.
Sure.
Pepper.
There's a lot of sadness with jazz musicians because you can't really... The problem exists all over the world. You just can't exist. Only the very few on top of that mountain, like Miles. And Miles, when Miles played, he used to use... The side guys would be getting peanuts. Miles would be getting all the... And that's how it was.
Big dollars and... Yeah.
Yeah. So the top people, the very few top people got the big bucks. And the side guys... It's like I was mentioning to you. Today, what I'm really bugged about is the fact that jazz musicians of Matt Ottignon's caliber, who's here right with us now, and who Lenny got, by the way, because I said, let's get some people with feel. A lot of young guys around with tremendous chops and everything, but the feel is of the utmost of importance. And Lenny's a great scout for that. Because he knows who the real people are. He said, Matt Ottignon and Mark Howard, we've got to get the... I said, who the hell are these guys, man? I didn't know them from a bar of soap. I haven't been listening to the young people. I haven't been around. I haven't been fronting up like I used to.
My listeners are a big fan of Matt's from his performances with the Java Quartet.
Right.
We featured...
I had the fortune of rehearsing with him for the first time and playing with him for the first time and with Mark the other day. And they're great players. Mark's a wonderful player. I'm really looking forward to... Because, you know, at rehearsals, you don't show all the things.
No.
On the night, everyone's going to pour it all out. They're probably practicing at home. I'll do this one, I'll do that one, you know. We all do it.
When you look back at the Free Carter period, what are your thoughts about that period? Was it more difficult to gain acceptance of spontaneously improvised music in those days compared to today?
It's always the same. Something new is always... Revolution is always bloody. If you bring out something new, they want to cut it straight away because it's very uncomfortable for the people that haven't created this new concept or thing. If I listen to the Free Carter albums of mine, in those days they were controversial. I listen to them now, they're lame in comparison. You know, I mean, the young guys are doing Free Carter... free improvisational stuff within the format of whatever they're doing all over the place now. It's not, and now with electronic sounds as well. We were doing it acoustically. And look, it was, I walked into Parlings and there were Free Carter, it said, Free Carter albums, big, you know, a stack of them advertising us, Free Carter, Serge Ermel's Free Carter.
Were they walking out with
it? No, and then it said, free, take one.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah. So I walked in, I said, what the hell's going on, man? He said, oh, we can't sell them, so we just get... I said, oh, no, you're not. I got them, and I took them, and I went on tour with Eddie Bronson and Louis Burdett. We went right around Australia, and we walked into record stores and virtually said, hey, Serge Ermel, Eddie Bronson, Louis Burdett, this is a new album that's out. Would you like to buy one? And we actually sold all of them by doing that, painstakingly. Because
yeah.
I used to... Because Bronson and Burdett were in record stores looking at jazz records, and I'm saying, no, man, we've got to sell our... Well, that was going on, you know. But we had a great time.
Yeah, well, that says something about your selling skills.
Yeah. Well, no, not really. It's just a game of numbers. The more people you see, some will buy, some won't. Most won't buy. But we used to have people throwing eggs and... we did one concert at the Sydney Festival with Free Carter with Brian Brown on tenor as well. And two drummers, I can't remember the other guy. Anyway, they were booing and hissing and throwing apples and tomatoes and eggs and whatever they could get. I think it was great. we had it was a furore, you know. It was better than all the other performers.
And this is a jazz audience.
Yeah. No, well, you know, there would have been a percentage of that audience that would have been a jazz-oriented people.
Interesting.
Well, Sydney Festival attracts everyone, really.
Yeah, The jazz heroes, Joe Lane, Keith Sterling, you mentioned. Why do you believe those artists are worthy of a tribute?
Well, they devoted their whole lives to the music, and all you have to do, the music, as Parker used to say, the music speaks louder than words. All you have to do is listen to their music. Number one, Joe Lane is just a genius. You know, like every jazz musician who came out here, who'd heard him, wanted to either play with him or they were in awe of his talent. I mean, when people first heard Joe, sure, because he used to sing, what the hell is that? But then if you really listen, and then a lot of his solos were transcribed, they were fantastic solos, beautiful creations of spontaneous, creative music. Keith Sterling, the same. He was a very unique trumpet player. He didn't play like any of the other trumpet players. And he devoted his life to jazz music. I used to listen to him at the El Rocco before I ever worked with him, with Lenny. So they're very special people. They're foundation blocks of the greatest history of Australian jazz music.
Now, both of them probably weren't recorded enough. So,
no,
you know, something like this is a great fanfare. But how can we go about preserving their heritage?
Frank, I think it's already preserved forever, for eternity, really. I don't think it'll dissipate in any way. I think it'll only grow, slowly but surely. Because we have to, all idioms need their history behind them. And this is part of the jazz history. We need the people that, the Mozarts, the Beethovens, these are the people, you know, on the jazz scene.
And Tony Barry, now, he was the star out of El Rocco then.
I was getting to Tony Barry. He grew up on the jazz scene with people like Poche and McGann and Bobby Gebbert, myself, etc. And he got into the acting profession, the acting world. And he's done something like 64 major films now, international ones and local ones. And I started to I asked him, I said, how would you feel? He did a one-man play called The Local Man recently at the Ensemble. And so I went along and I was really knocked out by that. And I approached him. I said, listen, Tony, how about we do a one-off thing where you do some of your favorite prose and poetry in front of some improvisations? And he said, fine, sure. Yeah, great, I'll do it. So that's how it came about.
James Anthony Astor, any comment on that one?
Yeah, we're going to do that on Wednesday night. It's a piece I wrote for my grandson, who's 8 now, and he's a tyrant. He's a lunatic. But he's the most beautiful, I'm biased, of course, being the grandfather.
Of course.
But so I wrote this piece for him.
Quite a frequent topic of mine with my guests, and in that Sydney just can't seem to compete with the level of gigs that are available to jazz audiences in Melbourne. And we were discussing some of the reasons behind that, the problem that we don't really have a 7-night-per-week jazz club here in Sydney, whereas in Melbourne they certainly do have one of those with a couple of stages and a couple of other, 2 or 3 other clubs that have jazz 3 and 4 nights a week. What's your take on that? What is the core reason? It can't be because Sydney people just don't like jazz.
Well, I used to think the grass was greener whenever I went to Melbourne, because it was exciting to go to a new place. But after years of going there, I realised that, this is my own personal opinion, I think that the people are just hipper there than Sydney. I mean, they're more cosmopolitan. Well, they're cosmopolitan over there, but they're just hipper to jazz. I saw that just through my experiences. Also, they're hipper with boutiques and restaurants. I think their cuisine and the restaurants there just blow Sydney away, really, and the boutiques as well.
You think this change in liquor licensing laws in New South Wales will improve the scene here in Sydney, to try and align it a little bit more with the scene in Melbourne?
I hope it does. I hope it does. I'm not sure whether it will or not. The mentality of restaurateurs here and promoters of jazz in clubs here is that when jazz music is played in a restaurant or an establishment, that the jazz public stay on 1 or 2 drinks for the whole night. And so the owners are really not very happy with that. They want people to drink, because that's where they make their money, not so much with the food, but with the alcohol. That's the big problem. Jazz people are not big drinkers.
Well, I think that was a big problem with the Soup Plus, where they had a young audience there, and in fact a lot of them were under 18, and they couldn't drink alcohol. They had to sit on a lemonade or a Coke or whatever, and it really wasn't making that club any money.
Well, I think that particular club at that particular time was there for other reasons than to promote jazz, and they were monetary reasons, taxation reasons.
Serge, I'd like to thank you very much for coming into the studio. Pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Serge Aumont, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.